This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This program contains themes of an adult nature. Word for Word is an in-depth look into the lives of real people, which means this episode may contain explicit accounts of real-life events, including alcohol and drug use. The language used at times may cause some offence, but has been left uncensored due to the accuracy of the story. No offence is intended, and we hope you enjoy the program.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, to over 70 community stations around the nation, this is Word for Word, coming to you from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy.
Welcome, family and friends, fans and fiends, to today's edition of Word for Word. I want to thank you for tuning in today. I'm Benjamin Norris, and it's simply a delight to continue to work on this show for the Joy Network, which has already featured some of the community's strongest voices. In the tradition of this ongoing program, I continue to look at powerful stories and insights into the life and lifestyle of some incredible people. Each week we will chat with those in and around our community who have inspired us, entertained us, but mostly they've made an impact on the queer community of Australia. Today's guests have ticked that box and a couple of others. They were both born in Melbourne, and while science and community have been their building blocks of life, it's been their undeniable love, companionship and truth that has made their story so unique. You may know one of these ladies for her work as Green Senator of Victoria, and you might also know the other for her work as a climatologist. But it's been the transition of gender for one of these public figures that has inspired and motivated the transgender community right across the world. This week's guests will continue to make an impact on the environment, and just by being themselves, they will continue to be adored by the LGBTI and wider community for the effort they've made in social change, in particular, acceptance and inclusion in diversity. I'd like to welcome you. And I'd like to welcome Senator Janet Rice and Penny Whetton to Word for Word.
I knew I was different, although for many years I did a good job of suppressing it.
When Janet Rice married Penny Whetton, Penny was her husband, but then she revealed a deep secret.
I hoped it would go away when I met Janet.
For us, as a couple and as ourselves, no, we're just the same people we ever have been.
After 31 years of marriage, Janet Rice and Penny Whetton say their love for each other continues to grow. But their relationship is one of the most unique in Australia. Senator Rice and Miss Whetton, a Nobel Prize recipient, are one of the few same-sex couples in a legally binding marriage.
It's an important week for the LGBTIQ+ community. And for me personally, as a proud bisexual woman and a member of this parliament.
The community in the end is behind you. And work towards having politicians that reflect how the community really feels.
Is it weird at this stage of your life to become heroes the way that you've become? Do you see yourself like that at all?
No!
I don't think of myself that way at all.
It's something for my generation and me being in the queer space that I know who you are. But obviously the wider community also has such a fondness for the two of you, which is great.
I still find it really, really strange. It is. It's really strange. I mean, I've sort of, my public profile has, you know, in all sorts of, you know, as green fields, environment fields, you know, started in my early 20s. Mm. And so there was that sense of not being afraid to put myself out there, but knowing that, but no one knows who I am. And even as a senator, you get the feeling that no one knows who I am. I can walk down the street and no one knows who I am. So I still find it surprising that, in fact, there are people that notice the work that I'm doing and notice Penny and me.
Absolutely. It's about small amounts of notoriety, I think, in certain fields. Like in some spaces, you guys are incredibly well known. But I guess there's other people out there that might not know that much about politics.
That's right, who aren't engaged. Mm. And certainly I find it humbling, but also really a privilege that the work that I'm doing is sort of making sense to people and making a difference to people and inspiring people. I spoke to a woman today who's got a trans daughter in Adelaide, and she's fighting to have a gender clinic services at the Women and Children's Hospital in Adelaide.
Yeah, right.
And she said that her daughter, Georgie, sort of feels, because of seeing me speak out, it sort of gives her confidence that she knows, right, you know, that there's Janet sort of speaking out on her behalf, and that she can, you know, feel that energy and that sense that she's going to speak out as well. It's lovely.
It's sharing your story, though. Mm. And I guess in some ways we try and be so private about our lives, and so we should be. But I think because your story resonates with people and does make a big difference for young people, does that make it easier for you to open up and share more about your lives?
Yeah, and it seems more important. And certainly, I mean, Penny needs to answer this rather than me, because, you know, I'm there. I've put myself in the public role of the senator, so there's that sense that I am a public person, whereas for Penny it's sort of been much more reluctant to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I could say that, you know, I went through my gender transition those years ago, and really it was to get the whole gender get over the whole gender business and get on with the rest of my life, which means I had a natural inclination to sort of put it all behind me and not think about it so much. And then I felt guilty that I wasn't actually helping the people that were in my situation that had come along in the more recent years. So having the opportunity, particularly since Janet became more well known, for me to be able to do something in this way is good. Yeah, it makes me, it means I don't feel guilty about not being so helpful.
And it was funny, though. I mean, when I was first elected, and there was so I had a range of portfolios, newly elected senator, so, you know, transport and forests. I didn't have LGBTI issues in my portfolio at that stage when I was first elected. So I was wanting to get all of this, you know, a bit of a focus on my portfolio issues. And all that the media wanted to talk about was Penny and me. And, you know, and there was a bit of reluctance to begin with, but then it was almost, okay, you know, that it's valuable, that it's serving a purpose, so let's just go with the flow and make the most of this. And I think, and then it sort of died down a bit after that, and we were happy to, right, okay, let's talk about other stuff rather than the two of us. But then when I had the LGBTI portfolio, and then particularly during the marriage equality campaign,
absolutely,
and with trans people sort of being left out of the campaign a lot as well, both of us decided it was, you know, something that we could really do that would really make a difference. Yeah.
In the first few years after my transition too, it would have been harder for me to have had a public role, because there were people in my life that I still, or how's the best way to describe it, you know, this would have been an issue for them as well. But now there's so much, you know, 10 years or more further on, I don't have any reason not to speak.
You might not have felt comfortable to be talking like we are today 10 years ago.
No, I probably wouldn't have been as comfortable. No. Mm. And Janet knows that the way I've generally lived my life is I just take the opportunities as they come. And this seems to be the time to open up more about this than it was at an earlier stage.
Look, we're going to get into a little bit more of that, but we want to talk about the origins, like the upbringing that the two of you had. So you grew up in Altona, was that right?
I did, yes.
Okay, yes.
Yeah, where my mother still lives. She's still at the house that I grew up in, yes.
That's amazing. Mm. And did you have similar upbringings? Like, Penny, where did you grow up?
East Brighton. Probably broadly similar. Mm. Yeah, I had a happy family of... There were three children, and my parents have passed away now. But no, I had quite a nice childhood in that respect.
Mm. Were there similarities between your childhoods at all?
I was the middle one of five kids, so
big family.
That's right. And I think my skills as a negotiator and a facilitator come from that role in the family.
I love it.
But whereas your two sisters were considerably older than you,
almost an only child, because my two sisters were 10 and 14 years older than me.
Oh, so. Wow.
I think probably the similarities with this, we both had parents that were very happy for us to do whatever was, you know, what we wanted to do, to follow our passions, follow our dreams, sort of, and not be, you know, pigeonholed into being something or doing something that we weren't. And for me, particularly, sort of as a girl growing up, you know, in the 60s and 70s, I didn't have any feeling that there was things that I couldn't do as a girl, which I know a lot of women my age were very channeled into only doing things appropriate for girls to do. Whereas for me, I thought, nah, you know, girls can do anything. And I think, you know, my mother is a strong role model of, you know, she went back to work, and my youngest brother was quite young. And so she was, you know, bringing up a family, working, active in the local church in terms of, yeah, you know, you can just juggle all of these things. That's what I grew up with.
Absolutely. What school did you both go to?
My high school was Brighton High School.
And yeah, so I went to, you know, local primary school in Altona, and then I won a scholarship, and so then went off to Lowther Hall, the girls' school, Anglican girls' school in Essendon, and which was, yeah, good education. But the other thing I loved about going to school in Essendon and living in Altona is that I got to catch the train to school every day. So I had that time independent of both being at home and at school, sort of travelling on public transport to and from school.
Another thing that might was a bit similar about our upbringings is that both your parents and my parents sort of introduced us to the natural environment.
Yes.
Our love of that. I mean, you had... Yeah. Well, we used to go to my grandparents' house in Cockatoo in the Dandenongs. So we used to, I remember as a kid, often walking through Sherbrook Forest and being amazed by those trees. And you similarly with...
Yeah, camping holidays at Wilson's Promontory at Tidal River every summer, and then going off on camping trips to northern South Australia, and my father sailing his boat in the 1970s on flooded Lake Eyre. So we had three trips, in fact, when Lake Eyre had water in it in the mid-1970s. Again, you know, Mum and Dad just sort of pack up the family and, you know, off the grid for 2 weeks.
I think your father was a frustrated explorer.
Oh, I think he would have been, yes.
But don't you love that? I mean, that's the same thing for when I grew up. I mean, my earliest memories is Sherbrooke Forest, is having the Sunday lunches with my grandparents. That's, you know, my early memories of being out there. But I think having that kind of lifestyle as well, it helps you be sort of more aware of the world, of the bigger picture.
Yes.
Is that how you both felt?
Exactly. Yeah. And you know that there's more to life than just, you know, your own small existence, that you have that awe of the world.
Yeah.
And the other thing for me is, and I think, I mean, both of us, our parents were churchgoers. You were a churchgoer for longer than I was. We both consider ourselves to be atheists these days.
When was the last time you both went to church? You have to tell me.
I would have gone to church on a Christmas or an Easter with my mum probably in the last... maybe not 5 years, perhaps 10 years.
My mum was not that religious, but she made us go to like Sunday school and influenced us, you know, so that if it was something that was interesting to us, we could adopt it, you know, which I think is good.
And I similarly didn't feel I was... I think my parents sent me to church and Sunday school because they just sort of felt it was the right thing to do. There wasn't any strong pressure from them to indoctrinate me.
And what I was going to say about going to church was that also is a time in your life, and, you know, time every week where you actually think beyond yourself. Mm. And so it is that whole sense of, you know, your what you can be doing to be helping others in the world. And I think that there aren't as many spaces for people growing up that they have that, you know, structured, you know, ritualized time each week to actually think beyond themselves and to think about the rest of the world and the rest of humanity. So for me, that's the thing that I really appreciate, having had that.
There are churches for atheists.
Yes.
I don't know how.
They're at PCYC's places. There are community places you can do that. And I think that there's definitely a place for it. I mean, for some of my friends who've gone through hard things in their lives, their religion's been really powerful.
Mm. And that strong sense of community you get from people that you are worshipping together with, and that sense of shared common purpose.
None of us is going to church anytime soon.
No. But
that's all fine, and as long as they can be not force their views on others who aren't interested.
So what was school life like then for the two of you? I mean, do you both have fond memories of going through high school?
I do, basically because I didn't rock the boat very much, although, you know, I was an independent thinker, but I was academically very capable. I was good at sport as well, so, and, you know, played music. I basically every extracurricular activity in the whole school.
That's right. Was that different for you, Penny?
In school was very straightforward for me. I mean, I was academically very, very good, which helped. In the social side of it, I could never quite decide whether I was amongst the mainstream kids or amongst the
misfits.
Yes, the misfits. I seem to have connections into both groups, and I'd swap between one and the other.
When you tick some of those boxes, being good at academically and also being able to do sport.
I wasn't so much doing the sport at school. I hated the rough and tumble sports.
That's right. You didn't
like... But the ones that weren't rough and tumble.
You weren't comfortable with the sort of the very macho, to feel that, you know, be a physical boy.
We share that in common, though. Yes. I was the same. Like, as in, it's just for some reason, I don't think I was designed that way. I think that's probably the best way for me to put it. Mm. I'd like to have been better at sport, but it wasn't my natural flair. So, Penny, you got a passion for science. Well, you both did. Got a passion for science. What age was that when you started exploring that or realizing that that's kind of the career that you wanted to have?
It's interesting. I actually primarily trace it back to my father, because he was rather interested in science, but he didn't have the opportunity to pursue his scientific interests when he was growing up. He had to leave school at 14 and get a job because it was the Depression, etc. But he read lots about science, and he would talk to me about it. And I think that was probably my first inspiration for science. When I got to high school, particularly the latter years of high school, where you had to choose the science or the humanities streams, I don't remember it being a hard decision. I seem to think that naturally I'd do science. So maybe that just went back to the background I'd had in science before then. And I liked it. I loved it. I had a physics teacher in my last year of high school, which I found quite inspirational. That made me certain I was going off to university to do physics, although I eventually got physics out of my system at a later stage.
For me, I really enjoyed maths. And I love doing maths. I love solving problems and solving puzzles and things like that. And then sort of the science sort of almost went along with that. So that developed, through that, I think, developed a very logical, rational approach to the world. And so science made sense. Similarly to Penny, I was good at maths, I was good at science, and so there was a bit of a sense of, well, if you can do it, well, you should do it.
I think there was a bit of that sense as well.
Yes. And then when I finished year 12, I really didn't know what I wanted to do. And
you didn't know at that stage?
No, I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I found meteorology a lovely connection of it with scientific, but it still had a connection with the natural world and sort of understanding, trying to understand, and that curiosity about how the natural systems of the atmosphere and the environment worked.
You both met, though, at university, is
we
that
did.
Right?
Yes, that's right. When Penny was doing her master's and I had just finished third year, that's right.
Cold Fronts Research Program Phase 2.
Two, that's right. So essentially they were...
Penny, I love that you remembered it.
That's right.
Janet's like, okay, yeah, it's coming back to me.
No, Cold Fronts Research Project, in fact.
Oh, okay.
So that's right. And we had, it was a research project that they engaged students to go off, and they set us up in various locations across southeastern Australia to be tracking cold fronts as they came across southeastern Australia. So essentially we had to put up weather balloons every 4 hours.
And track them through a theodolite.
Through a theodolite when a front was coming through. So we had 10 days together with a group of students.
There were six of us in a house on the beach in
Pelican Point.
And if there was no front coming through, we were still paid to be there, but there was nothing for us to do, so we just sort of were on holiday. And then the front came, and then there was this intense bout of scientific observations. So that was when I first got to know Janet. Yes. I'd seen around the place before that, but
keeping an eye on her.
And then there were a couple of things. I mean, one, in fact, just before we left, had been my 21st birthday. In fact, it was we left the morning after my 21st birthday, and Penny always says that she never got invited to my 21st birthday.
I was there
party
the next morning, picking her up from her house. The rest of there were six of us in the car, and they're all talking about the party the night before, and I was the only one that hadn't been involved.
Why didn't you invite?
Well, I didn't know her at that stage. Oh. No, she was a couple of years older than me. But one of the presents,
I don't think you've gotten over it.
No, that's right. One of the presents that I'd got for my 21st birthday was then the first edition of Leon Kosterman's book Trees and Shrubs of Southeastern Australia, and we still have it, and it's gone. How many editions that's gone into in the last 35 years? Who knows? And so I had this book, and then so I hadn't done any plant identification. I didn't do biology at school, didn't know much about plants, but I was had natural, affinity with the natural world. And Penny found this book and she loved it as well.
I'd never done any biology at all.
Yeah.
And I wasn't interested in it because of biology. I think I was interested in it because it had little maps.
Yes.
I always loved maps.
But the other thing that attracted me to Penny was that I'd, been 3 years at that stage with scientists, and so many scientists are pretty nerdy, narrow, not really having an engagement with things beyond their science, and I found them a bit boring. But Penny had a broader range of interest, and in particular, her reading on this trip was a book, and you can probably remember what it's called anyway. It was by Herodotus, so Greek history essentially.
Well, the first history book ever written in 500 BC.
Yes.
Right.
And so classical literature, I suppose, but I was reading it in translation.
I think this is amazing, and then you're broadening Janet's horizons.
Well, and this thought of this person, you know, she's not just your standard, you know, run-of-the-mill scientist who's only got scientific interests. She's got a broader range of interests.
I've always had a love of history.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, why did I never go close to going down that path? And it was partly, it was really because I never, didn't really think about doing the humanities in the later years of school. So then I get to university and... So, okay, my history is just
It's a parallel life. You could have easily gone down that path.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm a professional busybody, so you have to tell me, what was it like then at that time when you both started to fall in love?
Well, I had to break up with my boyfriend at the time. So.
What's his name? A little shout out. No, we won't mention his name.
Oh, we still get on together very well.
Oh, you still know
him? Yeah, we still know him. I'm Ian Rogers. In fact, he was Australia's first chess grandmaster.
Wow.
Well, there you go.
these nerdy men that you're
That's
obsessed
right.
with.
Yes.
I love it.
So that was a bit sad, but yes, that had to happen.
Nothing happened between us at the Cold Fronts research project. It had to happen afterwards. But I do remember when you put your woolly hat on my head.
That's right. There was this frisson of excitement between us. That's right.
That was the connection. It was meant to be.
And then it was summer and we spent some time together. In fact, you came down to the prom, didn't
you? Yeah, yeah. The relationship got going shortly after that, yes. Afterwards. But my memory of spending time with Janet at the Pelican Point was, it just felt so natural and normal being with it. Had a really nice fitting in sort of feeling.
Is it interesting in a way, because I mean you've both lived your lives as a heterosexual couple and now you live your life as a same-sex attracted couple. Is it a weird world to live in where you've lived those different lives?
Yeah, I mean, we went from being, you know, the perfect ordinary, you know, heterosexual couple living in our heteronormative world with our, you know, living with the two kids, and everyone saw us as just being a very standard
the Aussie family.
Yeah. And suddenly, that's right, we were presenting
suddenly
to the world something very different.
I found myself thinking twice about, you know, kissing Janet in the street or holding her hand and so on, because I thought, oh, what will people think?
Yes.
Isn't that so weird, though? Like, my partner hates PDA, so he won't even, like, I would try to hold his hand all the time. There isn't a day that goes by where I don't try and hold his hand. We've been together for 9 years, and he hates PDAs because of the culture of the same-sex attracted couple.
Yep.
However, for the two of you, you both were able to live that life of being able to express yourself without any concern.
Exactly. And we brought that into our relationship. And that's sort of, you know, I don't think about the fact that people would view us as differently. And I have to, you know, you get reminded of that.
Yes.
You know, rudely reminded of it sometimes. But for us as a couple and as ourselves, no, we're just the same people we ever have been. And so I know we are not there yet in terms of equality, because there is still that stigma and that internalized censorship that same-sex attracted people and, you know, put themselves through.
You were set to both be adopted by the LGBTI community later in life, but what was your impression growing up? Like, what did you think of the queer community? Like, what did you think of same-sex attracted people as you were growing up?
For me, why don't you start, Penny?
Well, it's an interesting question. I haven't thought very hard about it. I knew I was different, although for many years I did a good job of suppressing it. And I knew it wasn't that I was gay. It was something else. And I only learnt more about it by reading about it, etc., when I could, furtively at times.
Pre-internet days.
So I kind of had a feeling that that wasn't my community, so I didn't pay a lot of attention to it. I'm just thinking back now because I haven't really thought very hard about that question. And I'm thinking back like in my school days and very early 20s, etc. I didn't feel connected to it at all.
See, for me, I always thought, like, I actually was quite scared of the queer community, or I was kind of terrified of the queer community. And so for my generation growing up in the 90s, no one talked about their sexuality at school.
No. And for me, I mean, I remember at school in the 70s and I identified as heterosexual and I now identify as bisexual, and certainly, you know, I was attracted to girls, but because you live in such a heteronormative world, you know, well, if as long as you're attracted to boys as well, well, you just ignore that, you know. Absolutely, so you can fit in as a heterosexual. And of all of the girls at my school, I mean, I think, you know, there was one girl that we said, oh, you know, we think she might be a lesbian. But that was that, you know, the 500 girls at the school. Nobody absolutely would, you know, if they were a lesbian or bisexual, would they felt confident enough or embracing that enough to be able to be out.
Did it take you some time to work out which letter of the alphabet you wanted to identify with?
Yes, yeah. I mean, my one of my friends, sort of, when Penny transitioned, sort of called me the accidental lesbian.
Penny, look what you've done to her.
Right, but now the accidental bisexual. But, it's, you know, I reflect back at it and I think, yes, you know, I have been attracted to girls and women throughout my life as well. And clearly I was attracted to Penny when she was a bloke. So, you know, that's what I am. And the difficulty is when you're in a long-term committed relationship, you know, what is your sexuality really? Because I've got this deep love for Penny, and that overrides everything else. And so you sort of just tend to not go there really in terms of, you know, thinking about
You're 32 years into this marriage.
That's right. Yeah. How attractive you find other people, because it's not relevant.
No. Exactly.
That's what I often think of, like, you know, even being with my partner for 9 years, you know, I'm just lucky to be in love.
Yes.
And I think that's what's so powerful about your story. And maybe you both resonate with this same theory as me, but some people feel like they're owed to be in a relationship, or we, you know, that's what's going to happen in their lives. But you're really lucky to be able to find it. And if absolutely. You find it, you've got to protect it.
Yes. Absolutely. So lucky and privileged.
For many years, I didn't tell Janet about my gender issues because I was so afraid of the damage it might make to the relationship, and the relationship was number one for me.
Were you afraid that Janet was going to leave you if you told her about your gender dysphoria?
I was a significant part of me didn't believe that would happen, but part of me also worried that it might.
And Penny's a worrier.
Yeah. So it was difficult. It was difficult. And eventually the dam broke.
Love conquers all, though.
That's right.
Yeah.
I think that's what you're both lucky to have had, though, that there's genuine affinity to each other. There's a genuine attraction to each other based on an attraction of minds as well. I mean, you're both...
Yeah. We and see the world so similarly.
We do. And the fact that if there are issues that come up in our relationship, we will work through them and we'll talk through them and we'll talk about it. And certainly, you know, when we're first discussing and juggling Penny's gender identity stuff, it was huge for both of us, but we just talked so much and sorted through it. But I mean, some couples can do that and then the sexuality just doesn't work for them. And I know there are some trans, you know, people who when one partner transitions, and as much as they would like to make it work for them, it doesn't. Whereas I think we're also fortunate, and for me, you know, there was that moment of when we were out dancing together and with Penny as Penny, and, you know, we were dancing and I sort of looked at her and I think, yeah, you know, I absolutely still love her and I find her really attractive as well. So there was that sense of identifying.
That was really nice.
Yeah. That she was a woman and, yes, you know, I was absolutely still in love with her.
That's
as
the
a woman.
Best.
That's right.
I mean, it is a combination of things. I mean, it is about sexually being attracted to someone and being in love with them as a person. So
yes.
I think you're both lucky that that's what's been able to stay strong.
That's right. And I know, you know, the deep sorrow that some people have that it doesn't work out for them like that. And we've got other, you know, a trans friend in particular.
Close friend. It was the breakup of their relationship, yeah.
How did you tell Janet? Like, how did you get those words out of your mouth?
I would be rehearsing the words in my mind so much. You know, what would I say? And then I decided, well, I'm going to write them down. And so I wrote a letter to Janet, which I redrafted and redrafted. And then I eventually got it in a form which I thought would explain things adequately. I'm trying to trick myself here in a way, because I then thought, okay, the words exist. I don't have to stop. I don't have to worry about them anymore. Now it's just about the opportunity.
Where do you hide a letter that you're rewriting like that, though?
It was probably being rewritten on the train and going to and from work.
When I was at meetings or something. Yes.
Anyway, so I then had the letter ready in the bedside table. And so all I needed to do was just decide, yes, this is the moment, and grab the letter and give it to Janet to read.
where do you go when that letter is being written?
Being read, yes.
You know, well, yeah, that's the thing.
I did. I was sitting there.
Yeah, that's right. Well, we'd just gone to bed.
Yes.
You know, and fortunately it wasn't too late. And we'd just gone to bed and Penny hands is here, I've written this, you know. And so I read it. And this sense of, you know, this doesn't happen to me. You know, this is the sort of thing that you read about in books or see in films. You know, it doesn't happen to people in ordinary life. And that was, you know, and I think it's really worth thinking about, you know, in 2003, 13 years ago, how less of a profile trans people had then. And sort of, you know, most people don't know another trans person. Yeah. They've never seen, you know, no, very little media coverage of trans people. So it was this, gosh, you know, here's this weird thing, and Penny's telling me that that's, you know, that's.
Was there much sleeping that night?
No. We talked a lot.
Because I read
until
to go
until about
to
4 a.m., I think.
Still thinking about it. Yeah, because I read to before I go to sleep to calm me down.
Yes. But I think that's right. I'm trying to remember the circumstances because you were about to go away on another overseas trip.
That's right. Yeah, and I wanted to tell. I'd made my mind to tell.
You'd given yourself a deadline.
Yeah, before that trip.
Because you'd had previous overseas trips, which, you know, once Penny's scientific career had taken off, which had given her the opportunity to travel, and so we were spending time apart. And that's when she realised, well, you can tell your own story.
There was cross-dressing going on, which was I hid from Janet, and I'd buy things and then throw them away.
Where were you buying them?
Somewhere where I was extremely unlikely to not be recognised.
Timmy. Yes.
Where you went to, yeah, you're in Richmond on Swan Street, just buying this for my wife.
Yes, yeah.
But I just got so sick of the hiding it. But, you know, when I throw things away, I'd tell myself, oh, it doesn't exist anymore and it won't come back, which was rubbish because, you know.
Curiosity leads you back to it. Well, I guess in some ways, you know, like we often go out into the world and we see things that we want to buy to wear. Mm. And I guess when you do have issues about your gender, you're going to be drawn to the identity you want to present as, your mind wants to present as. Mm. So you probably see things in a catalogue or something like that and think, I want to know what that looks like on me.
So, yes, that's why that prompted the telling Janet about it.
And then we went and off and bought you some clothes the next morning.
This is the best.
That's right.
I love your house. I love the fact that you have this letter at night time. You stay up till 4 in the morning. Practical Janet says, let's go shopping.
That's right.
It may have not been the very next day, but it was close.
It
works better in the story. In the story to hear that you went shopping for it the next day.
That's right. Shopping for some frocks.
Now, at this stage, how old are the boys?
Well, this was
2000 and, oh no, it was 1990. I mean, they didn't know for quite a bit longer.
Yeah. So this was about 99, wasn't it, I think?
97, I think. 97.
Right. What was the first time that you had an adult conversation with your boys about what was happening in their parents' life?
Not for some years, yeah, and not until...
Was that until they were ready, or was that until you were ready, or you both were confident?
Well, for a number of years, I would take the view that they didn't need to know because I wasn't going to go any further. I would have my time out as Penny, you know, once every couple of weeks or something. And maybe that would be enough. And I started going to Seahorse Victoria, which gave me an outlet at that time. So there was the hope that it wouldn't go further at that point. So I wasn't going to tell them while I felt like they didn't need to know. And they were fairly, you know, fairly young. The interesting thing was we had this close friend. I established a close friendship with someone I met at Seahorse Victoria. So they would come to visit our place as Matt, and then we would go off and change somewhere else and would go to Seahorse and whatever. So my kids had got to know Matt. And then Matt transitioned to Nat. And so they saw that and learnt about it before they knew it was actually going to happen to someone even closer to them. So it actually made it easier, actually, having them having an understanding of what had happened. what was to happen or what had happened.
The importance of role models again, which people have, you know, there are so many more of them now, but they were, you know, they just weren't there.
What's interesting in that scenario is that's a real lesson of respect that you taught your boys, and that is that obviously while Matt went to Nat, you obviously both showed respect.
Indeed.
And then she was our good friend.
Exactly. So, I mean, they saw that genuine empathy and love and care for someone who's a friend. And then that's obviously the same thing that they would have had to process, like a little map.
That's right.
Penny, you like maps. Yes. But like a little map for your kids to be able to follow.
Yeah, absolutely.
What are they like about it now? How has that been for them? Like, how do they
feel
about it?
Well, they don't report those conversations to us, really. So I don't know a lot about those sorts of conversations that they must have from time to time. What about you?
Yeah, I think...
The door's open for you to have that conversation.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think they've just been supportive of us. I mean, certainly in terms of the impact on their lives, you know, at the time when Penny transitioned, or when we told them that Penny was transitioning, it was the very practical things. You know, they both wanted to make sure that she was going to keep on playing footy with them, for example. And so then we had to go through, you know, being the social transition at their school and at the footy club. And I've always felt that being in, I mean, we still live in Footscray, living in Footscray, it's such a diverse and very multicultural community.
Absolutely.
That there was very much that acceptance of people, and a very progressive school community that accepted people for, you know, whoever, whatever they were. So it was, you know, I think that acceptance was there, and they didn't have to have too much of a struggle. The main thing that we hear is that we heard from them was that they didn't quite know how to explain who Penny was. And so in conversations about, you know, people's dads, you know, having to talk to people who, you know, newer friends who didn't know who Penny was, and sort of having to just say that, yep, you know, they do still have someone who is their dad, but they just don't refer to her as their dad anymore. She's Penny. Yes.
And a part of me was a little bit sad about having them not stop calling me dad. They couldn't call me. It didn't feel right to claim mum as a term, because
mum
that
existed.
was Janet's. And having your children use a name which, you know, relates to the special relationship they have with you is kind of nice. But dad was just not possible anymore. But I rapidly got over that, and they call me Penny, and that's absolutely fine.
And basically it's just we're just, you know, mum and Penny. So that's what they still at, you know, at age 27 and 24, you know, we're just mum and Penny.
I mean, you know, in many sorts of ways, you know, things that stressed me in the early stages of transition, I look back and think, well, you know, I just got over that. And
it is still a grieving process to lose things like that, you know, and people forget about that. They think that's where there's a bit of a lack of respect, I think, for other people, because it is a process for you to detach yourself from titles that you probably feel deserved, you know.
Yeah. And things like, you know, Father's Day was one. And in fact, we've talked about this with Nat as well. We feel that there really should be an Other's Day, as well as Mother's Day and Father's Day. It should be an Other's Day. So not just for people who don't fit into the mother or father category, but, you know, so many carers in people's lives, whether it's the grandparents or the other carers, you know, to be recognised and acknowledged, rather than having this binary, we have these cultural celebrations of mothers and fathers, and if you don't fit into that, you know, gender binary, well, you're not acknowledged.
Just don't tell the capital C Conservatives about this Other's Day, because that will give them something to do.
That's right.
And I don't think we need to give that to them. It is an interesting world that, you know, I guess you both have been able to navigate. What do you both believe is the key to have made this relationship a success?
Communication. Love. You know, the ongoing love, but communication and openness and willingness to be open to things. You know, not being closed to possibilities.
I think we're both like that.
Yes.
Which helps
and
a lot.
Seeing, you know, when things that you don't expect, you know, pop up in your life, not seeing them as barriers, but seeing them as opportunities. And there might be problems, but then a belief that you can get around them rather than sort of being overwhelmed by them, which is my optimism.
I was about to say, Janet's positivity is really quite amazing, and that helps a lot.
Do you know what strikes me is that I think you're both realists. Like, if a piece of information comes across your desk as a scientist, you look for the reasons as to why this is and solve a puzzle.
Yes.
If that makes any sense.
That's right. Yeah. I think, yeah, and working out how to solve those puzzles.
Penny, what advice would you give yourself if you could have a conversation with yourself at the age of 12, knowing what you know now?
Oh, it's so hard because the world's changed so much. And, you know, if I'm thinking about if I was a 12-year-old now, it's such a different world to then.
Yeah, I mean, we met some wonderful young trans kids in Canberra during the week, and I was just so moved just talking about them. And, yes, they, you know, struggling with their life as young trans kids, but it's such a different experience for them than for Penny, who, you know, didn't disclose her gender dysphoria to anybody until she did to me, you know, at the age of 40-something.
But, Penny, your story is so important, and people, when they Google it here in Australia, if they look for someone to look up to, Penny, you are that person in lots of ways. Yeah. And whether or not you set out to be that, which I don't think it is that you did, but just by being yourself and sharing your story. And the best thing I can tell you about seeing you today is just that you look happy. And I think that's amazing. Like, yeah, that's setting a role model, that's setting a storyline for younger people at 12 that life's going to be okay.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I hope it does, because life has been wonderful.
Yes.
And just thinking back again to your question, though, it's anything I could say to myself as a 12-year-old doesn't feel relevant to now, because the world is just so, so different.
But there'd be, I mean, if you, in terms of things to share with 12-year-olds who are suffering,
that's a different matter.
Struggling with their gender identity.
I guess you have to compartmentalise that question, because there are different universes and there's different lives and there's different timelines. You know, what happens to someone in the 60s, 70s and 80s is completely different to what's happening.
Yeah. But, you know, there's no doubt. I mean, we saw the, you know, three young trans kids who were supported by their parents and, you know, going for it. For every one of those, there'll be three young trans kids across the country somewhere who are feeling that they can't tell anybody about the fact that they're, you know, not really a girl, they're really a boy, or the other way around. They know that their parents aren't going to be supportive, who might be expressing transphobic stuff to them just in passing, and they would be having all of that bottled up inside them. So
yeah, I mean, the main message is that it's certainly okay to feel as you do, but you know, the more specific advice depends so much on their circumstances. Yeah. I really wouldn't know. I'm struggling as a scientist with this one, I think.
I think it's, you know, that embracing who you are is a good thing.
Yes.
And the journey, you know, for every individual will be different. And
absolutely.
Sometimes it's going to be harder than for other people. But embracing your identity is something that is incredibly powerful.
Well, Penny, I guess you know this, and I think a lot of people know this. I mean, the more that you push against who you truly are, the harder it is for you. So it's a race that you can't win if you're going to try and run away from your true self.
There's an issue with sort of classifying to yourself who you are at that age, and I really had very few options. And that made it hard too. Like, am I this? Am I gay? I don't think I'm gay. There weren't very many options to choose between, but there's a much understanding of the broader, different ways that people can have a gender experience.
Yeah. Well, and think about the letters that have been continuously added to the LGBTIQ, and that is because there are so many stories.
And I'd advise people not to be too rash to try and to necessarily leap to one categorization.
I know both Penny, both of your parents are no longer with us, but were you able to have a discussion with your parents about your gender while they were still alive?
It was quite sad, really, how that unfolded. In that my father was, at the relevant time, my father was in a nursing home and not really mentally capable of having a conversation about that. My mother was not really quite as she had been either, due to an illness that she'd had a year or two earlier. So I did talk to her, but we found it was quite a difficult conversation.
Was that one of the bigger obstacles, would you say?
Yes.
I think that's what you were referring to earlier when you were talking about...
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's funny, I actually think if I'd talked to my mother some years earlier, when she was more as I remember her, I actually think she would have coped with it much better. Mm. It was just sad that it came quite late in her life and when she wasn't really as well as she once was. And
her mind wasn't working.
Her mind wasn't working quite as well, yeah.
It's a hard thing, you know. But I guess in some ways, I always think of this for myself. I've had some really bad hardships that have happened in my life, but I've also been balanced out with some really good things. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the good ways of, or the only way of looking at it when you're faced with something that's quite sad like that, mm-hmm. is to be thankful for what it is that you've been able to have. Yeah.
And the other, yes, you know, that it was sad that your mother wasn't able to come to terms with, you know, and truly accept you as Penny. But on the other hand, virtually everybody else in our families and friendship circles have
so,
you know, and so that bubble. Amazing acceptance by people, and yeah, which is just being so surrounded by love.
Yeah. And my work environment, CSIRO, was fantastic.
They got on board.
Yeah.
You hear it like ANZ, you hear about all these corporate businesses these days being so much better at inclusion, and it's so amazing. Like you just think.
And the news of Deakin Uni, did you see the news?
No,
that they've now got special transgender leave for people undergoing gender transition. So there's like separate special leave.
Much needed. Right. You're both so brave, and like talking about all this is obviously being quite difficult, but at the same time, it's so powerful for other people to listen to. Did you ever think that you'd become prolific like this?
Oh, some years after my transition, I had the strong feeling that I wanted to write a book about the experience. And I actually ended up taking some time off, some long service leave. And I got about a third of them to half the way through what I was planning to write. And I ran out of steam. But my intention there was to tell my story and that it would be hopefully helpful to others.
Will you go back to writing that book?
I don't think so. I think having this opportunity to talk about my experiences and hopefully in a way that can help others through doing podcasts like this and other things we've done in recent years is taking the place of that book. I don't think I'll go back to the book.
She should actually publish the bits that you actually wrote. It would be worth really just sort of getting them up online and as a resource.
On the whole, I do still find this a little hard, and it's not... I certainly don't enjoy seeking attention for myself in this, just as Janet was saying. Yeah. But when you hear these messages back, which we do quite often, about how incredibly helpful, you know, us appearing in an article or some other interview or that's occurred has been for somebody, that makes it so worthwhile.
Yeah.
And makes me willing to do these things again.
Stepping out of that space just for a minute, Janet, what are you most proud of that you've achieved in your career thus far?
Probably there are two, I don't know. I mean, there are two tangible things that's ongoing that I think, you know, I played a big role in those. One was the formation of the Greens in Victoria. So, you know, one of the people that decided in 1992 that, we needed the Greens, and they were really a pretty small group of us. And so it was a big driver in making that happen. And to see the Greens grow and to have the political power that we have, and again, you know, having that political power as a tool to be able to get the change that we need in the world, seeing that, I'm really proud of that. And the other goes back to my days as a forest campaigner when I spent 7 years working in the environment movement, and by being a leader and facilitating, you know, thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of people to be taking action to be protecting our forests. We ended up with the Erinundra National Park in Far East Gippsland and protecting some of the wonderful old growth forests in the Roger River forests, which were in addition to the Snowy River National Park. And to see those as national parks and protected where they otherwise would have been logged and destroyed, I feel, that was a really important thing to have done. And then I think the other thing that I really, overall in the work that I've done, is I'm proud of bringing people together and helping people to get involved and to feel that there's something they can do and make a difference. And so, you know, and I think it's my positivity and my optimism and of actually engaging people and saying, yes, you know, get involved, make a difference. And so there are lots of people, for example, that I know, you know, have been got involved in the Greens because they've heard me speak or they had a conversation with me and they got inspired. And I think that's a pretty good thing to know, and then to see them blossom in their activities as well.
I love that, because your work has been a combination of science and community.
Absolutely.
And bringing those two together.
Yes.
And that's been a real building block for everything that you've had to go through in life.
And very much, you know, working with people in a really respectful and caring way, and you know, seeing the good in people and bringing people together to achieve good things.
Penny, what about yourself? Stepping out of the space of talking about your journey in the LGBTI world, what are you most proud of that you've been able to achieve?
Oh, I'm proud of my scientific career and the achievements I've made there, and I hope I've had an impact on how we're dealing with climate change. I'm proud of my relationship.
Yes. I should have said that too. And our kids,
and
absolutely.
Our children.
What about your ambitions now? Like, as in looking forward, you know, do you both have something that you want to achieve before finishing up in your careers?
Oh, look, I want to see Australia take serious action and contribute towards tackling dangerous climate change. Otherwise, we're completely stuffed as humanity and the planet. So, and we've all got to play our role, and Australia is, you know, such a laggard and such a contributor to sort of global pollution with our massive coal mining. And so, yeah, so actually I would feel, you know, at the end of my days, to feel that, yes, we've turned things around and that things are going to get better in terms of climate and environment and protection of nature as well. And I'll keep on being passionate about those. Yeah, that's, you know, that's the big one for me.
And that's actually important for me too, very much.
I think it's remiss of us not to have the two of you here and talk about, like, in 2016, the Australian ran a front page story about safe schools. And as that came about, certain lobbyists were able to take down safe schools. How did that make you feel at that time?
Oh, absolutely.
It was
appalled.
Terrible. Yeah.
And the power of the right-wing media to do that and to destroy something that was so important for young people is just appalling.
What do you think needs to be in place now? Like, what needs to go there in
well,
place?
Well, basically, it needs to come back.
Just the same thing?
Well, a whole range of measures to deal with homophobia and transphobia, you know, throughout society. And so having programs in schools to be building support for and acceptance of, and to end bullying, and to, you know, be building resilience, you know, across school communities is absolutely essential. Sort of thing we need to be putting resources into and standing up to the right-wing bullies.
How do you feel about Scott Morrison? I mean, you've both been in Parliament this week fighting that cause in particular. You know, do you have a message for Scott Morrison about what he needs to be doing?
To me, it's that he's out of touch with ordinary Australians. He does not represent... Most Australians are good people. They are respectful. They are caring. They're accepting, whether it's of our multicultural diversity, it's refugees, people who are different, you know, LGBTI people.
He doesn't represent mainstream Australia.
No.
How does someone like the Prime Minister of Australia be so out of touch with what the country needs? Is that a reflection of the capital C conservative culture of the Liberal Party and just that they're in power
now? It's just the way the Liberal Party seems to work these days, I think.
Yes, and they have basically been taken over by capital C conservatives who are not reflective of mainstream Australia. And we saw that, you know, with the marriage equality debate last year. And although I would never wish the postal vote on us ever again because of the damage it did to the community, the one silver lining was Australians got to say how they felt about equality. And, you know, we had almost 2/3 of Australians saying, yes, they supported marriage equality, and which was, you know, completely out of tune and out of kilter with what the Liberal and National parties are saying, that this is what how they wanted to legislate and didn't want to legislate.
But why can't they still be reflective of what Australians want?
They've got to lose at the next election and lose badly, and to realise that they're not going to get back in unless they realign themselves with where the mainstream Australia are at, and that they are not doing that at the moment. And whether it's, you know, their position on climate change, their position on refugees, their position on LGBTI rights, they're basically governing for they're the big end of town. They're governing for themselves, for their mates, for the corporations, and they're not governing for mainstream Australia.
How do you think Karen Phelps is going to go?
I think she'll do really well. And you know, it means we've got now got six independents in the House of Representatives, a minority government. I mean, she's a very intelligent, capable, articulate person. I think she's going to make a difference.
Have you got a message for the queer community that might be listening to this now?
Believe in yourself, that and the community's got your back, really. And
yeah, I like that perspective. The community in the end is behind you. And work towards having politicians that reflect how the community really feels. And that should guide your voting.
Yeah. And if things are tough for people, to remember that things can get better and it may need,
And things are so much better now than they once were.
Yeah.
And I think that there's no doubt that trend will continue, maybe in some fits and starts, but we know where the world's heading in the long run, I think.
And in general, that you are loved.
Oh, yes.
Mm. This is the last difficult question I'm asking for today before we wrap up. It's always a hard one. Are you both happy?
I'm happy.
Yes.
And I'm very happy with how my life's unfolded, which I have no regrets about the decisions I've made through my life. And that's a nice feeling to have. Mm. And that helps certainly to make you happy.
Well, you're both incredibly powerful people who've made a huge impact on the world, both in your work and in your lives. I want to thank you both so much for coming in here and being so generous with your time and opening up to talk today.
Thank you, Ben. It's been
thank
great.
You for the opportunity.
Word for Word is presented and produced by Ben Norris from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy. Word for Word is distributed nationally to over 70 radio stations across the community radio network.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.